On January 11, 1983, I took the oath of office for the second time before the largest crowd ever to attend an inauguration in our state. The celebrants had brought me back from the political grave, and their support would keep me in the governor's office for 10 more years, the longest period I ever stayed in one job. It was a decade devoted overwhelmingly to improving education and the economy. In late 1983, I called the legislature into special session to implement new school standards recommended by a committee Hillary had chaired. We couldn't create more jobs without improving education. That was evident in my efforts to recruit high technology companies to Arkansas. And we couldn't make real advances as long as we were last in spending per child, teacher salaries, and total state and local taxes per person. What we needed to do was both to raise the sales tax and to approve the higher standards recommended by Hillary's committee. The legislature met for 38 days to consider 52 bills in my agenda. Eventually, it approved the standards, the sales tax increase to pay for them and to increase teacher pay, and the nation's first law requiring teachers to pass a test to renew their certification. I continued to push for educational improvements for the rest of my time as governor, but the new standards, funding, and accountability measures enacted in 1983 laid the foundation for all the later progress. In July of 1984, Colonel Tommy Goodwin, the director of the state police, asked to see me. I sat in stunned silence as he told me that my brother had been videotaped selling cocaine to an undercover state police officer, one who, ironically, had been hired in an expansion of state anti-drug efforts I had asked the legislature to fund. Tommy asked me what I wanted him to do. I asked him what the state police would normally do in a case like this. He said Roger wasn't a big-time dealer, but a cocaine addict who was selling the stuff to support his habit. Typically, with someone like him, they'd set him up a few more times on videotape to make sure they had him dead to rights, then squeeze him with the threat of a long prison term to make him give up his supplier. I told Tommy to treat Roger's case just like any other. Then I asked Betsy Wright, my chief of staff, to find Hillary. She was at a restaurant downtown. I went by to pick her up and told her what had happened. For the next 6 miserable weeks, no one outside the state police knew, except for Betsy, Hillary, and I believe my completely trustworthy press secretary, Joan Roberts, and me. Every time I saw or talked to Mother, I was heartsick. Every time I looked into the mirror, I was disgusted. I'd been so caught up in my life and work that I'd missed all the signs. Shortly after Roger went to college in 1974, he formed a rock band that was good enough to make a living from playing clubs in Hot Springs and Little Rock. I went to hear him several times and thought that with Roger's distinctive voice and the band's musical ability, they had real promise. Roger clearly loved doing it, and though he went back to Hendrix College a couple of times, he would soon drop out again to return to the band. When he was working, he stayed up all night and slept late. During the racing season, he played the horses heavily. He also bet on football games. I never knew how much he won or lost, but I never asked either. When our family gathered for holiday meals, he invariably came late, seemed on edge, and got up a time or two during dinner to make phone calls. The warning signs were all there. I was just too preoccupied to see them. When Roger was finally arrested, it was big news in Arkansas. I made a brief statement to the press saying that I loved my brother but expected the law to take its course, and asking for prayers and privacy for my family. Then I told my brother and mother the truth about how long I'd known. Mother was in shock, and I'm not sure the reality registered on her. Roger was angry, though he got over it later when he came to terms with his addiction. We all went to counseling. I learned that Roger's cocaine habit, about 4 grams a day, was so bad it might have killed him if he hadn't had the constitution of an ox, and that his addiction was rooted in part in the scars of his childhood and perhaps a genetic predisposition to addiction he shared with his father. From the time he was arrested until almost the date of his court appearance, Roger couldn't admit that he was an addict. Finally, one day, as we were sitting at the breakfast table, I told him that if he wasn't an addict, I wanted him to go to jail for a very long time because he had been selling poison to other people for money. Somehow that got through to him. After he admitted his problem, he began the long road back. By then, the case had been taken over by the U.S. Attorney, Asa Hutchison. Roger gave up his supplier, an immigrant even younger than he was, who got cocaine from his family or friends in his home country. And he pleaded guilty to 2 federal offenses before Judge Orrin Harris, who had been chairman of the Commerce Committee in the House of Representatives before going to the bench. Judge Harris was in his early 80s, but still sharp and very wise. He sentenced Roger to 3 years on one charge and 2 years on the other, and suspended the 3-year sentence because of his cooperation. Rogers served 14 months, most of it in a federal facility for nonviolent offenders, which was hard on him, but probably saved his life. In the summer, I led the Arkansas delegation to the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco to see Walter Mondale and Geraldine Ferraro nominated and to give a 5-minute tribute to Harry Truman. The Democrats were in trouble to start with, and it was all over when Mondale said he would propose a hefty tax increase to reduce the budget deficit. It was a remarkable act of candor, but he might as well have proposed the federal car license. In the November election, Reagan defeated Mondale 59-41%. The president won 62% of the vote in Arkansas. I received 63% in my race against Woody Freeman, an appealing young businessman from Jonesboro. By the end of 1986, I had formed some basic convictions about the nature of the modern world, which later developed into the so-called New Democrat philosophy that was the backbone of my 1992 campaign for president. I outlined them in a speech to the year-end management meeting of Gannett, the newspaper chain that had just bought the Arkansas Gazette. These are the new rules that I believe should provide the framework within which we make public policy today. 1, change may be the only constant in today's American economy. 2, human capital is probably more important than physical capital. 3, a more constructive partnership between business and government is far more important than the dominance of either. 4, as we try to solve problems which arise out of the internationalization of American life and the changes in our own population, cooperation in every area is far more important than conflict. We have to share responsibilities and opportunities. We're going up or down together. 5, waste is going to be punished. It appears to me that we are spending billions of dollars of investment capital, increasing the debt of corporations without increasing their productivity. More debt should mean increased productivity, growth, and profitability. Now it means, too often, less employment, less investment for research and development, and forced restructuring to service non-productive debt. 6, a strong America requires a resurgent sense of community, a strong sense of mutual obligations, and a conviction that we cannot pursue our individual interests independent of the needs of our fellow citizens. If we want to keep the American dream alive for our own people and preserve America's role in the world, we must accept the new rules of successful economic, political, and social life. And we must act on them. Over the next 5 years, I would refine my analysis of globalization and interdependence and propose more initiatives to respond to them, juggling as best I could my desire to be a good governor and to have a positive impact on national policy. While I was doing my job in Arkansas, Governor Mike Dukakis of Massachusetts was moving to secure the Democratic nomination for president. A couple of weeks before our convention opened in Atlanta, Mike asked me to nominate him because I was his colleague, his friend, and a Southerner. They wanted me to take the entire allotted time, about 25 minutes. I was flattered by the invitation, but wary. Conventions are loud meet-and-greet affairs, where the words coming from the platform are usually just background music, except for the keynote address and the presidential and vice presidential acceptance speeches. I had been to enough conventions to know that another long speech would bomb unless the delegates and the media were prepared for it and the conditions in the hall remained conducive to it. That night I was introduced and walked out to strong music. As I began to speak, the lights were dimmed. It was all downhill after that. I wasn't through 3 sentences before the lights came up again. Then every time I mentioned Mike's name, the crowd roared. I knew right then I should scrap the speech in favor of a 5-minute version, but I didn't. I felt as if that speech was a 200-pound rock I was pushing up a hill. I later joked that I knew I was in trouble when at the 10-minute mark the American Samoan delegation started roasting a pig. A few minutes later, the ABC and NBC networks started roasting me, showing the distracted convention hall and asking when I was going to finish. I had some good lines, but alas, the biggest applause I got was near the painful end when I said, in closing. It was 32 minutes of total disaster. I kidded Hillary afterward that I wasn't sure just how badly I'd bombed until we were walking out of the arena, and she started going up to total strangers and introducing me as her first husband. Fortunately, Mike Dukakis wasn't hurt by my misadventure. He got good reviews for naming Lloyd Benson as his running mate. They both gave good speeches, and the ticket left Atlanta with a healthy lead in the polls. On the other hand, I was a dead man walking. On July 21st, Tom Shales wrote a devastating piece in the Washington Post that summed up the press reaction to my speech. As Jesse Jackson had electrified the hall on Tuesday, Governor Bill Clinton of Arkansas calcified it Wednesday night. He called it Wendy Clinty's classic clinker and described in agonizing detail what the networks did to fill time until I finished. A day or so after I returned to Arkansas, I got a call from my friend Harry Thomason, producer of the successful TV show Designing Women, which his wife, Linda Bloodworth, wrote. Harry told me I could make silk out of this sow's ear, but I had to move fast. He suggested I go on the Johnny Carson show and poke fun at myself. Carson normally didn't invite politicians on the show, but apparently he had made an exception because I was too good a punching bag to pass up, and because I agreed to play the sax, which he could then use as an excuse to keep his ban at least on non-musical politicians.